You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Joanne MacArthur. She's an award-winning photojournalist, author, and activist, and she's been documenting the plight of animals on all seven continents for over 10 years. She's also the subject of the Canadian filmmaker Liz Marshall's documentary, The Ghosts in Our Machine. And her first book, also entitled We Animals, was published by Lantern Books in 2013. She has many more rewards and publications too numerous to mention in this brief introduction. Thank you so much, Joanne, for talking with us today.
Hi, thanks for inviting me along.
To begin with, I think I'd like to talk about how I discovered you and your work, and as it was through Facebook, which I'll detail in a minute, but it seems that for photographers as well as artists, which other artists are connected to, Facebook can sometimes be a wonderful way to understand what's happening in other people's worlds. And the photograph that I saw, which began with the line, "If ever a picture broke my heart, it has to be this one, a baby clinging to its mother who's about to be shipped off to experimental labs somewhere in the world." And it's a picture of, which will be included perhaps in this interview, it's a picture of a chimp, a small monkey, with a baby clinging to it, and a man holding its arms behind its back. It was very upsetting, and what I first thought of when I saw it, which often happens on the internet, is, oh my God, yeah, this is so upsetting. I didn't see, couldn't find the petition to sign, and then I began just, since your name was watermarked on there, I began researching you and your book, and I wanted to know exactly what was going on in that image,
wow,
which I still couldn't find out about. So to begin with, before we talk about your book and your career a little bit, can you tell me a little bit about that image and what that means, how that happened, how it was taken?
Yeah, I sure can. And also with Facebook and social media, it is such a great way to get message out about animal rights. It's been revolutionary, really, for the movement. But that photograph was taken in Laos, and that's at a macaque breeding farm. These are macaques who are being shipped worldwide to be used in labs for research. I was undercover at the time, working on a film, well, helping with a film called Maximum Tolerated Dose by a Canadian filmmaker, Carl Ojachowski. And so we were posing as monkey buyers, and we were there, and what that man is doing is he's holding a monkey, a mother, and he's holding her with her arms behind her back so that she can't get away. And when he scooped her up from that cage, her baby actually just leapt and grabbed onto her last minute. And what you're looking at is this baby holding onto the mother's chest with a look of fear and agony. And the mom is looking down at her child with a soothing face. But in the meantime, you see the hands, these big hands of this man holding her arms behind her back. And what he's doing is showing us his product. And she's not an individual. She's not a living being. She's a product, according to him. It was one of the hardest moments I've ever had as an animal rights photographer, because, of course, this was just devastating having her shown to me in this way, when, of course, you know, I'm on her side. I don't want her to be treated this way. So when he picked her up and showed her, I quickly took a few snaps and said, okay, we've seen enough. Please put her back. But also having to do that without, you know, getting upset, without blowing your cover, because we're there as buyers, right? We're not supposed to care. So that's what's happening in that picture. And as a matter of fact, the images were used in that film, and they were used in The Ghosts in Our Machine, another Canadian documentary. But most importantly, those images were used with the group, the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection. And they were able to present our investigation at CITES Convention in Geneva. And as a result, two of the three farms that we went to were closed down. So we're really, really happy about that.
And so tell me a little bit more. Of course, that's, you know, yeah, that's very upsetting. And it's you know, fascinating to hear that story. So you're undercover and you take this photograph. If you continued as an undercover person who is purchasing the so-called product, would you have, it would have been possible to buy that a cow from him right there?
Not right then and there. We said we were working for universities and entertainment companies in the USA, and that if their monkeys were in good shape, that we would, you know, the people we were representing would, you know, buy a couple hundred monkeys or something like that. So he was keen to have our business. For the most part, what we said is that, you know, we didn't want him touching the monkeys or showing them to us. We just wanted to walk around and photograph the animals in the cage, which is what we did the entire time, except for that point when he took the monkey out.
And normally, so that monkey would be for sale. They could sell you one monkey,
yeah.
And it would come with its child or with its
baby?
No.
No, I'm sure it would be without the baby. And I don't know if you could buy just one. I mean, these places are, and also, like, for the most part, they're shipping these animals to China or to the U.S. So, yeah, I don't know if you could just buy one, but I suspect not. I think they were interested in us because we said we were going to buy a large quantity and have them shipped overseas. Most people just buy them, you know, once they, these animals live in just a state of stress and starvation. They don't feed them very much because they don't need to. They just need to keep them alive. They get sent to China for the most part, and then they get their papers reworked so that they look like they're from China, not wild caught or not kept in these barren cages in Laos. So they get the paperwork redone. They get fattened up, from what I understand, and then they get shipped beyond that. So most people, you know, would never know about these monkeys kept in Laos in these awful conditions. They are just, you know, people in labs or universities making another order for 100 monkeys or 50 monkeys or 1,000 monkeys. And then they come, you know, ship from Air France or all these companies and ship them overseas. And then there you are with your boxes of monkeys.
Wow, that's you know, it's very difficult to hear. So these are almost all going to labs. Essentially, that's what these breeding farms are for. As the first step in going to China, which sounds like kind of a middle person there, and then they're all shipped to the labs where they're essentially experimenting and killing the monkeys, ultimately, I would imagine, all over the world.
Correct.
Wonderful that you're doing this, Joanne, and I'm happy that we're talking today, although it's so upsetting to hear about this. I'd like to move back. I want to talk about the film and your book, but I'd love to learn a little more about how you got involved in this. And we can go as far back as when you were a child. Was there a first experience where you realized that you were interested in photographing animals or just being a photographer, period? I'm interested in your career as an artist as well as an activist. So what got you going at a young age on this?
Yeah, well, I can tell you about that and then tell you some happy rescue stories as well to balance that awful story of the macaques. Well, you know, I always had not just a love for animals. But a lot of people have a love for animals, for sure, but I always had a concern for animals. So, you know, the squirrel that was hit by a car, or a bird, a wild bird in distress, or a dog barking in a backyard. When I was really young, there was a neighbor who had a dog, and the dog lived outdoors all four seasons, and I could hear him barking all the time. And so even as a young girl, I was probably 10 years old, I went and knocked on their door and asked if I could walk their dog or play with the dog, just so that he'd be less lonely. So I think, you know, it started with situations like that. And, you know, I was always fascinated or obsessed with even photography and photographs. And eventually, you know, just through finding my way and, you know, life takes you on different paths and you learn different things. And long story short, what I realized was that I could combine my two loves, which was my concern for animals and my love of photography, to contribute to the world and make the world a better place. I've always been a person of service, you know, volunteering since I was a kid, doing all sorts of things. Luckily, I was able to find a way that was sort of unique. You know, there are not a lot of animal rights photojournalists out there, and there's definitely a need. So, you know, that was over 10 years, maybe 15 years ago now that I've been doing this, and it's turned into something that keeps me really, really busy.
So that's fascinating. Let's talk about then just before what happened maybe 11 years ago, when you were about to transition into this. And was it after college, or what was it happening right in the year I guess about 11 years ago when you were moving into this, what was your job or education level or artistic?
Well, when I decided I was going to be a photographer, it was halfway through university. I was studying English and geography. I didn't know what I was going to do with that, but those were my interests. And as an elective course, I took a black and white printing class. And on day one of that black and white printing class, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So, you know, and I also knew, well, I don't think I really need to finish university, but I did anyway. I got my degrees, but started assisting other photographers, starting finding mentors, doing internships, and pursuing that full time. And so that was, you know, it was probably in 1996. So, yeah, close to 20 years now, 20 years ago that I took that course.
And sorry to interrupt, but this was in Canada, correct?
Yeah. I was studying in Ottawa, Canada. This is where I'm from.
Okay, so then go on. You were pursuing your photography career, and what led into the transition of really bringing those two together? I don't know if it was a series of jobs or people or influences.
Sure.
What is
it? Well, I think there were a few things. In 98, I was backpacking and working in Ecuador, and something happened. I was walking along a street, and there was, again, a macaque monkey, actually, who was tied to a windowsill. And he was tied such that he could barely go in the house or out of the house. But he was trained to pick the pockets of people going by and rifle through those things. And, you know, people were stopping and looking at him and taking photos, and they thought it was really cute, and, you know, how he was reaching out for people's things. And so there was a crowd around him taking pictures. And I stopped as well, and I also took pictures, but not because I thought it was cute or funny, but because I thought it was awful. And I recognized that the people around me didn't seem to think so. And I thought that was crazy. And I actually wanted to share how I felt about the situation with others. And that was the purpose of my photographs of this situation. And I thought, well, I have an opinion about this that I actually think is important. And, you know, that grew into, I was able to, you know, take that idea and make it into a huge project, you know, not just the monkey, but then look at the farm animals, the food animals, the animals used in vivisection, the animals used in entertainment. You know, like the elephants and the tigers will go and we'll buy a ticket and go to a circus or go to a zoo and just ogle at these animals. And, you know, it's just what we do, right? It's what we've always done since the existence of these industries. And I think that it's wrong. And I wanted to share my point of view with others. So it started close to home, the project, you know, started with things like this, things that were really visible, animals in zoos and such. And then it turned into documenting things that were less visible, industries that people don't want us to see, whether it's mink farming or macaque breeding or layer hen facilities. There's a lot of things that happen behind closed doors that people need to know about so that we can make better consumer choices. So that's what's been happening.
Okay, a few more details about that. In Ecuador, what was the work you were doing at the time when that experience happened with the monkey that you photographed?
That's funny. I was actually working on an ecotourism guidebook for the Amazon basin. I was the photographer for that book.
Okay. and then that's interesting. So then after that, do you want to pursue more? And you talk about mink farming and everything else to move forward, maybe not all the way to your book right now. Did you continue to do photojournalism in other respects to sustain you financially while you were getting involved in this movement, or were you able to move right into it and sustain yourself?
No, for the most part, how I make my living is also as a photographer. The animal rights work doesn't really pay, but I have photographed probably over 450 weddings at this point. So I shoot weddings and events. I used to shoot food photography, but it's a contradiction to the We Animals project. I can't be saying save the animals in one breath and then photographing burgers the next. So I gave up the food photography a bunch of years ago, which cut my paycheck in half. And, you know, people donate to We Animals now, and people donate flights, which is just absolutely crucial. Because I'm flying all the time to various places to document. So it's been a transition. You know, I used to be a full-time commercial photographer. Now I do full-time We Animals work with a little bit of commercial work thrown in, and also living or doing the work off of, you know, small grants and donations. And, you know, I'm down to about 5 weddings a year instead of 55.
Right. Well, and like you're saying, you said people also donate flight so that there's some in-kind support of what you're doing so you can travel and continue to work without going into debt.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Like, I don't spend a lot of money, but I don't make a lot of money either, and it's working out. I used to chase the stories. You know, I'd look at what groups like Animal Equality were doing in Europe and call them and say, hey, you know, I would do anything to come and work with you guys and document your open rescues. Can I come? And so then I would raise the funds for those trips, or, you know, Sea Shepherd and all these things that I've done. But now it's the other way around. It's groups contacting me and saying, hey, we'd love to work with you on our projects, and we'll pay for your costs. So quite often, you know, I have a couch to sleep on, and meals are there and flights paid for, and we work. And well, it's been interesting. Like, I've sort of put faith in the idea that if I give a lot, I will get back and it will just work out. And it has so far. Like, my policy for sharing the images is very different. It's a different business model. It's actually not really a business model. any images that I've shot for We Animals over the last decade or so are available for free for anyone helping animals, whether it's someone working on their PhD or it's PETA or Sea Shepherd or anyone. So I'm not making money on these images. People can make a voluntary donation for usage if they like. But, you know, this is where it sort of gets interesting, in that, you know, my photography versus my activism. I used to say I was a photographer first, but definitely I'm an activist first now. What's most important to me is helping animals. And so I'm able to do that through making my images public and free. And, you know, that's not going to pay the mortgage, but, you know, it's what's most important to me. And it's working out so far. Like, I'm giving a lot, and then just people really appreciate it, and donations are made, and, you know, small ones, but enough to keep me going. So it's pretty neat, and hopefully I'll be able to just, you know, keep going with this and not ever have to start taking on more weddings and things like that, because it's not a good use of my time, obviously, at this point.
Right. In a way, the way I'm reading that is also, you know, this is where your passion is. This is something that's genuinely helping the world, and this belief that you're saying in giving seems to have really not worked out. I mean, obviously it is working for you, but it's also one of those new paradigms that can happen now in social media, digital media, where it's we know people are grabbing photos anyway. Just, you know, we see these things happening in the music world too. People,
yeah,
creating CDs and offering their fans to pay what they wish. And it turns out, in the cases that at least we hear about anyway, that kind of idea of giving, of asking for a donation in many ways tends to work better than what previous economic models have set up, you know, such as selling and rights and all that entails.
Yeah.
But even more so, there's something more emotional about the passion in there. If this woman is giving her photos to a movement, you also know just by that gesture your dedication to the movement, which I would think would draw more people to you and think, I would like to work with her, which is partly what we were talking about before, but I'd love to also hear about a story of someone who just writes and says, yes, I'd like to work with you, and how a project unfolds.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are so many, there are so many projects right now. And, you know, there are a lot of requests, and I, you know, have to narrow my focus. I used to just say yes to everything and go everywhere and work with everyone. But my time is, you know, a bit more limited now. So I'm trying to work with things that are really, or groups or people who are doing something really new, novel, needed, and who have a long reach or who are able to take action in a really, really positive way. And positive is important. I really like, you know, a lot of animal rights work is like attack, 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 or like do this, go this, criticizing. I don't know. I try and stay pretty positive. Like, here's the shit that's happening, but here's how you can help. Here's where, how you can make things change. But, okay, just to, sorry, get a focus. Go back to your question here. Yes, like, for example, the campaign I'm working on this year is the biggest campaign I've ever worked on. It's year long. I'm in the field all the time, but I'm working on this and putting my energy into this because this work has not happened in this particular country before, so it's really needed. And it's a group of people who come together who aren't just going to put out the photos, but they have a budget for a national campaign. They want it to go international as well, and they are able to prosecute. So the places that we're investigating are going to be held accountable. Many of them will close down. So that's like, you know, direct action happening through my work and through the donation of my work. And so that's really exciting. And I wish I could tell you more about what that campaign is, but it'll be out at the end of the year.
And you can't say any more about who that organization is either, which sounds like a wonderful organization.
I can't say anything. No, I can't say what the industry is or who they are, but a few more months and it'll be out, and it's work that's never happened before. So I'm really happy to be a part of it and just really happy to be working with people who are really hardcore change makers. You know, they're not resting. You know, it started out with, hey, let's have Joanne go and do some photos. And it turned into, what can we do with this? And it turned into, wow, what you're documenting is just awful, worse than we thought. We need to close these places down. What are we going to do when we close these places down? Do we just euthanize the animals? No, that's terrible. Okay, so we need to find sanctuaries for these animals. So it just keeps getting bigger and better. So, you know, my loyalty always to groups that will push things that far.
That's fantastic. That sounds kind of like a peak experience of yours. In all that you've done and all that you've been working on, to now be working with an organization, which sounds wonderful, and look forward to hearing more about that in a few months, but that's truly changing the world, helping the world, seeing action happen through international law, I would imagine, as well as documentary evidence.
It's a really incredible group of people who have come together. Again, it started small with a small idea, but then we got... it started with one group. Now there are three groups involved collaborating, and lawyers and funders. There's a big company who said, we want to fund what's going on. This is important. So we can't even believe we have money for this, too. It's really great.
Wow, that is so exciting to hear.
Yeah.
And how do people, for those who are listening and think, well, I want to know what happens with that company and I want to know more about it, how do they hear from you more? Can they sign up to your mailing list on your website, or what would be the easiest way for them to hear the latest news on that particular project and what you're doing next?
Well, I guess I post a lot on Facebook. Unfortunately, I have to be pretty cryptic sometimes because sometimes I'll be working on a project that's not even going to come out for a year and a half, which just kills me, you know, because I'm going to these places. It's such an emergency for the animals. They're suffering. You know, I'm going in there and shooting and just leaving, and they're still in those cages. And it's excruciatingly long to have to wait and not tell the world. But, you know, eventually I can tell the world, and I have to be patient. So, I post on Facebook a lot, and then I'm way behind on my blogging, but I do blog. And, just that kind of thing. And they can sign up for the blog as well. And I guess that's
that would
it.
Be
that,
on
I sound so inadequate. Social media and blog, but maybe that's the extent of it.
That sounds fine. And through Facebook, it's your name, Joanne MacArthur, and the blog is on weanimals.org. Is that correct?
That's right. And I have a Facebook page for We Animals as well. So WE Animals.
And lastly, I want to talk a little bit about your book and the film project. How did the We Animals book come to be, and why is that an important project to you?
Okay, well, the book was on the back burner for quite a long time, and every photographer wants to do a book. It's a very exciting thing for any artist or photographer to do, but this goes back to putting out images on social media was going to be way more effective for the animals than putting out a book, which is expensive and timely, and maybe only a couple thousand people will see it. So the book was on the back burner, and then when Liz Marshall asked me if I would be the central human character in her film, The Ghost in Our Machine, she follows me as I do investigative work and other things, but she talked about, well, how can we make your story a bit more exciting, or what can we add to it? And so she tabled the idea of doing the book again, and it was really good timing to put out a film and a book at the same time. Also, there's over 10 years of investigative work now in the We Animals project. We Animals is now a huge international archive, so there's a lot of material. So I thought, okay, well, timing seems right. I'll do a book now. And we really sort of worked our asses off to get that out really quickly. I was working with Lantern Books and my wonderful editor, Martin Rowe. And we put out a 208-page photo book with 30,000 words, so lots of stories about the images. And we raised money through Indiegogo to make the book, because, of course, coffee table books are really expensive. And actually, it was pretty amazing. I hate asking anyone for anything, and I never do. So I couldn't imagine having to ask for like $32,000 to make a book, but it was the only way we were going to get the money. So we put out a crowdfunding, and those things last 60 days. And I put it out there, and I thought, oh my gosh, we'll never get $32,000. But because We Animals has such a following, and people know that I produce good work, we actually we raised the $32,000 in 11 days. And people were able to donate simply by pre-ordering the book. So donate and you get a book. Really easy and rewarding and exciting. So we made the $32,000 in 11 days. And then by the end of the campaign, we had raised $54,000. So we were able to actually pay the designers a bit better and pay the editor a bit better and make a bigger, better book. So that's how that happened.
That is a great story. And the book can also be ordered through the website, We Animals. Is that correct?
Yeah, the info is there at weanimals.org. Unfortunately, for now, it's cheapest and easiest to get it from Amazon, and you can get it from lanternbooks.com as well.
Okay, since we began, this has been a wonderful talking to you, and I think
thank you.
Will be very exciting to not only artists who are listening to this and hearing about your activism and your work, it's also exciting just to see how this has help the world and change the world. And we started off with, to me, such a devastating story. Is there another story about a photograph that perhaps you can reference that isn't as upsetting or is more triumphant in some way?
Well, luckily for the animals, luckily for my soul, I'm able to document stories of rescue. And that's really important, not just for me, to heal my heart from all the things that I'm seeing. But, some people are really moved by the images of trauma and slaughter and confinement. They'll see images of animals in cages and say, that's it. I'm not supporting that anymore. It's that simple. But interestingly, I'd say even more people are moved by the stories of hope and rescue. So someone who will see, a cow getting slaughtered in a video may not feel anything too much, but then when they're met, they are confronted with an image of a cow who was rescued and her story, and looking at the photos or a video, they might just, fall to pieces and say, I'm never supporting that industry again, and then making changes accordingly. So the point is, it's really important to share the stories of good. I do that a lot. I find that they're often bittersweet. There's a pig named Julia that I met, and she's also featured in the film The Ghost in Our Machine. Her story is there, and it's just incredible. She was at a factory farm, one of thousands of pigs. She was days away from giving birth, and she wouldn't move into the next crate. And the workers started beating her with an electric prod and a metal pole, and they beat her almost to death. And one of the workers, he you know, he was witnessing this and he actually couldn't handle it. And he called the authorities, and the authorities came, and so did Farm Sanctuary, because the authorities knew they needed somewhere to put this pig. And so they got there, and she was really, really bruised and bleeding and battered. But with some gentle coaxing and some kind words, Julia, her name, she only had a number at the time, but they named her, the farm named her Julia. You know, with some gentle coaxing, she did get up, and she did actually, with their help, get onto the transport truck and lay down in some straw, and they took her to Farm Sanctuary, where she immediately gave birth to 16 piglets. Pigs, I think, for the, like, will have maximum 14 nipples, but she had 16 piglets, so she needed help with all the breastfeeding. And she had, you know, she went from this life of deprivation and confinement and trauma to this place where the humans were really nice to her. And they bottle-fed her babies, and they made sure she had everything available to her. And what's so beautiful about Julia and so many of the animals that I've met is how forgiving they are. And within a week, Julia was you know, coming right up to humans. They do this snort when they're welcoming you and they want to say hi. And Julia was coming right up to our faces and doing this grunting right into our faces. And that showed happiness and that showed trust. So Julia just breaks my heart because she was treated so violently, as are so many of the animals that we eat for food. And she came around, and you know, she has the most beautiful life now, and she still lives with some of her babies. All the others were adopted out, but she lives with her babies, and she has a pond that she can roll around in, and she has grass, and she can root, and she can be a pig, and she's happy. And you know, those stories are so important to share, and she's really close to my heart.
This is a wonderful story to share. In closing, and I really appreciate your time, and especially your work and what you're doing and the whole approach you have. Is there anything you'd like to say to artists out there, as well as others who are probably thinking, you know, among other things, God, I wish I could have that effect on the world, or have that ability to change. There's so much passion and love and care in what you're doing, and it seems so satisfying as well as heartbreaking for you. But is there anything you want to say to the artists as well as listeners?
There is, and not just for artists, but for anyone. People, you know, will look at we animals or look at photos of trauma and see what animals are going through and get a glimpse of that and say, what can I do to help? People get really stumped. And what I have found over time is that people do best when they use their skills. And now you guys know what I do. I take photos, and that's how I contribute to making the world a better place. But if we're using our own skills, and if we're doing what we like to do best, then we're going to do it well, and we're going to enjoy doing it, and we're going to keep doing it. So whether you like to write or whether you like to fundraise, I mean, a lot of groups need fundraising to help run their sanctuaries, to help run their campaigns. Whatever you like doing best, find a way to do that, make the world a better place, and then you'll have some longevity from it, out of it, and you'll have immense pleasure from it as well. A lot of activists, people start out and they think, well, they should leaflet or they should do this, but they're not good at those things, and so they do it for a few months and then stop. You know, maybe you like walking, so you can walk the dogs, or you know, at the shelter, or you can, you know, there's so many things. So do what you love to do, and you know, we live in a world where we're pretty selfish and we look after ourselves. And that's why I think we're in the predicament that we're in here. But, you know, I think if we can all look outward and just give a lot more than we do, we can turn things around.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Joanne. I'm really appreciative, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.